Thank you. I'm going to start my talk by admitting that perhaps we don't know very much about genetic modifiers and what accounts for variability. But I'm hoping that you'll see through my talk that I'm going to try to enlist all of your support and help in trying to actually make this feasible to identify what indeed at the end of the day accounts for the variability that we see in the spectrum of our boys. You know, why do some boys end up in a wheelchair with severely weak muscles at 5, 6 years of age, and other boys end up in a wheelchair not being able to ambulate by themselves at 16 or 17 years of age? These are tremendous differences in how quickly the disease progresses. And we don't have a firm grasp of why this occurs in boys. We have some data from mice. We have some data from very intelligently designed experiments along the way. And we have some ways to environmentally manipulate how quickly boys progress. What I want to present to you is that I think it's in our power to actually address this question with the modern tools of genomics. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a lesson of what do we know at the moment. I'm going to give you a lesson of how does genomics proceed in this modern era post having the human genome sequence, and then what can we do about it? That's sort of the flow. So at the end, I'm going to also act as a blatant advertisement for participating in the Shen Connect as well. So please do. So as you heard in the first talks, there's no question that Duchenne muscular dystrophy is caused by mutations that are in the dystrophin gene. This gene's on the X chromosome. It's the largest gene in the human genome. It's 2 million base pairs. The human genome is 3 billion base pairs. You get a 3 billion base pair genome from your mom, 3 billion base pair genome from your dad, and this 2 million base gene, dystrophin on the X chromosome, is the single biggest gene. You have about 25,000 genes in your genome, and very small mutations, one base, the larger deletions of hundreds of thousands of bases all lead to the same phenotype, which is dystrophin is missing, and Duchenne muscular dystrophy develops. A typical course, and I put typical in parentheses because there really isn't such a typical course, is that the diagnosis occurs in the range of 3 to 6 years of age, with progressive muscle deterioration leading to wheelchair dependence by 8 to 12 years of age. That's sort of the standard course. And most mutations lead to a premature stop, as Andy had indicated, that leads to just no functional protein being made at all. That's the dominant flow that's happening. So what are some of the causes of the variability? Some of the causes are actually the exact mutation that's in the dystrophin gene. So if you have one type of mutation, you might have a more mild course. If you have a different type of mutation, you might have a more severe course. So I'm going to take the wild end of the distribution. So there are, if I take the very mild end of the course, there are 15 males, not just boys, with a very big deletion. So they've deleted all of exons 45 through 55. So this is a common area that's deleted. It's the most commonly deleted area of mutations in boys. So of these 15 males with this very big deletion, that deletion ends up being in frame, so the message is shorter, but it still makes sense. Like the end of the sentence still makes sense. But of these 15, they have a very mild phenotype, even though they have this huge deletion. So one man in particular was diagnosed at the age of 57 and was otherwise asymptomatic and is still walking at 63. So that's the extreme end, and that's a Becker's. That's like a very mild Becker's in this overall discussion. So there's no question that the exact mutation in the dystrophin gene can be very important. But for the most part, most of the mutations that our boys have lead to complete loss of dystrophin and there's no expression at all, and they have the much more severe end of the phenotype. And even within that severe distribution, there's variability. Another reason that even for the boys who have mutations that should be predicted to cause no dystrophin being expressed at all, one reason that's already noted by scientists is the presence of what's so-called revertant muscle fibers. What this means is that if each muscle cell is actually derived from many, many different muscle precursor cells, and they form themselves into a very long chain, and those are our muscle fibers that go for very long distances in our muscles. If we take a biopsy of the muscle, turn it on its side, and cut through it, that's what this image is on the left. And if we then stain it for the dystrophin protein, you can see most of the cells, this nice pattern of staining, which would be in white surrounding each muscle cell, is absent. But in this one child's biopsy, there's one myofiber, which actually has very nice expression. That's a so-called revertant fiber. It has come from the same cell type. It has a mutation. It shouldn't express dystrophin, and yet it does. And we don't know the reasons for that. It could either be that there's another genetic deletion that occurred that put things back in frame, or alternatively, there could be modifications of the mRNA processing in that cell that leads to it being back in frame and then being expressed. But what we do know is that some boys do this process naturally. Some do it more, some do it less. So even though you have the same mutation, some boys may be making a little bit of dystrophin. And this is part of the rationale for moving forward with exon skipping trials. And the plot on the right, it's a nice demonstration of this from a paper by Nicholson and colleagues, indicating that the more dystrophin, so on the y-axis is plotting the percentage of normal of dystrophin from a muscle biopsy that's expressed, the longer the likelihood are that you're going to be outside of needing a wheelchair for mobility. So clearly there's correlations of this sort, that is, the gene itself and differences in the dystrophin gene are important. But there's also other sources of variability. So for instance, environmental possibilities include drugs. We'd like there to be more drugs. At the moment, there's really glucocorticoids, and then there's many other experimental therapies or supplements that are used. Exercise, excessive exercise may be detrimental. How we care for our boys, it's possible that that could be altering how this process is proceeding. So these are non-genetic causes. There's overwhelming evidence. This is from a nice meta-analysis from Manzer and colleagues, published just in January 2008. Great reading if you have spare time to read 68 pages. But it's a very nice summary of all the glucocorticoid data, indicating that there's overwhelming evidence that every study indicates that there's some positive benefit. Exactly how much positive benefit is still up for debate. How long we should treat is still very much up for debate. What the relative ratio of severity of side effects versus the benefits is also a bit up for debate. But in general, if you combine all this data with long-term daily steroid usage, there's evidence that there's probably a two-year prolongation of walking, but controlled studies on exactly that point are actually lacking at this point. On the right is a plot indicating one center's data. So some subset of their children opted not to be on chronic steroids, another subset opted to be on chronic steroids. And then this is what's called the Kaplan-Meier plot. And it's simply indicating that the plot for the steroid-treated group is shifted to the right, indicating that there's a prolonged time until the children are needing a wheelchair use in their data set. This is not a controlled study, and we don't really know that there's not sort of sub-selection of the patients choosing steroids versus not choosing steroids. But this sort of data is seen over and over again. The other source, which I'd like to put forward, is that it's genetic. And I think there's very strong evidence that a lot of this variation will be genetic. But I mean genetic not in the form of what are the dystrophin mutations. It's conceivable that even with our careful genetic testing, we're missing some cryptic mutations. We don't really sequence the whole 2 million bases yet. We're not physically capable of doing that. But we search through all the exons. We do a very good job of searching for deletions and duplications and sequencing for the actual exon sequences, the sequences that are coding for the protein. But there can be mutations in this other, 1.9 million bases, which are these introns, which can affect the overall gene and make it malfunction. I'm not talking about those so much here. What I'm talking about is the other 99.9% of the genome, the rest of the X chromosome, the rest of the chromosomes in the human genome, and there may be yet unknown variants, and we can systematically search through that space and identify other potential genes. So you should ask, how variable is DMD? And is it really so variable that we ought to bother to search for these sorts of genes and increase our understanding of Duchenne? And if you look at the plot on the left, this is the same plot that I just showed you, and I'm going to interpret it a bit of a different way. If I take all the patients who have 0% dystrophin expression, they don't express any dystrophin, the youngest patient was in lost independent mobility at about the age of 6. The oldest patient lost mobility at about the age of 11. So even those people who have exactly the same sort of molecular phenotype of the dystrophin gene have a variable course. There's something else causing this. And we can even do the same on the upper part of the plot where the mean expression of dystrophin is about 25% of normal and there's quite variable course as well. On the right is a plot that I grabbed last night from the Duchenne Connect site. It's a fun site. It's interesting. I think it'll give us some feedback along the way. But this is actually the ages. This is a set of about 200 children, 221 children, who've lost ambulation, and they're reporting for us at what age did they lose ambulation. This is pretty nice. So this is of roughly 600 and some children that were available for me to look at last night. 221 had already lost ambulation, and they told me at what age they lost ambulation. This is a spectrum of what's being observed across the set of people who've actually registered on the site. We want more of that. We want this to increase by about 14-fold, and I'd like there to be about 14, 20,000 people doing this. And then the data becomes clearer, it becomes sharper, it becomes more meaningful. And each one of us plays a part in actually making this data more powerful. So the other thing I just wrote myself a note at the bottom of this slide is that if you talk to clinicians, very much as Vanessa had said, getting the exact DNA mutation doesn't necessarily predict what the clinical course is going to be. It's quite variable. But if you have a sibling, that's actually a pretty good predictor of how your child's going to behave. So what we do in typical genetic studies is for what we do in autism, for instance, is we look at the rate of autism occurring in monozygotic twins. They're genetically identical, so if one twin has autism, and it's genetic, we expect the other child to have a very high likelihood of having autism, and that's true. If they're siblings, since they're 50% related, we expect them to have a much higher chance, the second sibling to have a much higher chance of autism, and that's true. If they're sampled randomly from the population, they should have the population chance. So we can do those sorts of studies. Those haven't been systematically done in Duchenne related to this severity question. And that's data that we would like to try to gather as well. But from comments from clinicians, there does appear to be a strong genetic component. The other bit that we know about in terms of where genetic modifiers are and what genes are present is around using mouse models. So the MDX mouse, which are some slides from Andy's talk, is a mouse with a mutation within the mouse equivalent of the dystrophin gene. And we can use that mouse to ask, if we change genes, other genes, one by one, if we take a gene and overexpress it, does that make the disease less? If we take a different gene and we underexpress it, knock it out, does that change the phenotype, the severity of the disease in the mouse? And I'm just showing some examples. There's about a dozen samples, and they're reviewed in very nice papers. And we'll hear a bit about these as being very useful potential therapeutic targets. And that's the exciting aspect, is that once you identify another gene that may be changing how the dystrophic process occurs in Duchenne boys, that becomes a new avenue for how we can approach therapeutics, and it's a new insight. And so all of these things, the reason we're approaching utrophin is that Kay Davies had the very nice observation that if you knock just utrophin out, this phenotype became worse. If you overexpress utrophin, the phenotype in mouse becomes more mild. So the notion is, can we drive utrophin expression in humans and mitigate the process? We can form that process over and over again. At the bottom of the list is myostatin. If you knock myostatin out of mice and then you cross them with the MDX mice, those mice become better. The MDX phenotype is mitigated. So we can use these in very powerful ways. The downside of the mouse is all of these things that I'm talking about aren't kind of subtle little changes. They're huge changes, right? It's a Mendelian mutation on another Mendelian mutation, and we're not likely to find those things from the human studies, but it's also pharmacologically hard to mimic that in these processes. So I like using the human data because the variants are going to be more subtle, and they may lead us to things that we can more readily approach pharmacologically. So humans are enormously variable. We've got lots of differences. This is Muggsy Bogues, and I actually don't know the other guy's name, but huge differences in height, for instance, right? If you look around the room, there's huge differences in us. Those are largely genetic differences. We have many DNA changes between us. Siblings tend to look like siblings, and we've got all sorts of different shapes and sizes in this room. We can now search systematically through the entire genome with tools of the Human Genome Project to search for DNA variants, polymorphisms, or SNPs, that are accounting for many, many different traits. So instead of searching for variants that are affecting height, we're going to search for variants that are affecting how severe Duchenne muscular dystrophy is at the end of the day. This is the lesson on genetics. It'll be quick and fun. The Human Genome Project was largely completed in about 2003, where we had our first complete sequence of a human genome. And then over the subsequent next 3-4 years, there was a project called the HapMap Project, where we sought to try to sequence hundreds of individuals across many, many of these polymorphisms or differences that are between us, and then aggregate that information. And what has happened is, on the left-hand panel here, is this is actually ordering the chromosomes by size. So the bottom chromosome is chromosome 1, which is your biggest chromosome, up through chromosome 22, which is the second from the top, and then the X chromosome is the top. And these are their physical lengths. And the redder these are, the better the coverage is. The point is that every chromosome, every place in the genome is very well covered by these markers. We can look everywhere in the genome. The benefit of having done these studies is the plot on the right, which indicates that these markers, we might have to look at 10 million markers if markers were distributed randomly in each of us, but they're not. None of us are all that distantly related from each other. We come from a relatively smallish founder population, tens of thousands of years ago. And because of that, we share genetic markers at a very high rate. So we can take these millions of markers and say, boy, we only need a million markers to type to look at everything in the genome. That's pretty cool. A million sounds daunting, but with advent of microarrays and approaches to co-type a million polymorphisms for well under $1,000, this is possible to do on very large-scale studies. As a matter of fact, these basic tools for genetic studies are opening up avenues for approaching many, many different diseases, and we can use these as well. The future is clearly complete genome sequencing. We're far from that. We're probably at least a decade away from that, but that will obviously replace what we're doing for these polymorphism analyses. But the cost of doing such studies is well over $100,000 for each individual at this moment. So this is an example of the progress that we're making as a community around genetic assessments for common diseases. So most common diseases, arthritis, heart disease, what else do I have in here, diabetes, prostate cancer, these are not Mendelian traits. Duchenne is a Mendelian trait. One gene, a mutation, causes Duchenne. Most of these other traits, there might be multiple different mutations and a lifetime of environmental factors that push your risk for getting breast cancer, or push your risk for getting asthma or lupus into a different category. But the point of this is that even though there's many genes involved in these traits, along the lower timeline is our rate of finding them. So in 2000, we were finding very few of these. It was an arduous process, and once a year, a new gene was found. But by the time that these tools became sort of ubiquitous and we were able to look everywhere throughout the genome, which has just occurred in the last couple of years, there's an explosion of new findings, and this rate is still going up and increasing at an exponential rate. And this is possible because of those tools that are existing. So we're going to use this same approach to search for all the many genes that are probably out there and gene variants that are modifying the dystrophin process, the dystrophic process in Duchenne boys. The final bits that I'm going to talk to you about is what can we do about it. So we tend to think of ourselves as relatively passive participants in research, right? Doctor calls us up, doctor wants us to participate in research. Yeah, we go on a peer, we sit there for a while, fill out some forms, we participate in research. That's actually a pretty inefficient process. Definitely keep doing it. It's a great thing to do. Absolutely no downside to it. But it doesn't get us to the very large number of samples that are going to be needed for trying to approach some of these genetic questions. So there's a series of natural history studies. There's one run out of UC Davis by Craig McDonald, which we'll hear about a bit during this conference. There's another one, United Dystrophinopathy, by Kevin Flanagan, who's presented here previously. And these are terrific projects that require very detailed longitudinal assessment of individual subjects over the course of time. There's also coordinated clinical study groups, which are collecting patient samples, muscle study group, Synergy, Treat NMD, and these are fantastic things to participate. But even if we mass all those together, they might not be sufficient numbers of patients collected in a systematic way. So we need even larger groups. And this is a good thing, because it actually puts the ball squarely in our court. It puts it in each one of your court, which is that it's up to you to actually make this process occur at the end of the day. And I think that the tools that have been developed, for instance, Duchenne Connect, and there'll be other registries that will come online, are critical to try to participate in. And all that's going to be needed isn't a long clinic visit, isn't necessarily long and continuous sort of visits. And this distributes the effort and allows people in rural communities to participate equally as possible as folks that are immediately down the street from University of Pennsylvania. And so there'll be simple sort of clinical measures that are taken. Oops. And info on whether chronic steroids were taken, because that modifies sort of where you were on the severity spectrum. And then info regarding the specific dystrophin mutation, which is critically important, and everybody needs to have dystrophin mutations done. But in the end, once that data is collected, we sample from the ends of these distributions. So we plot that data out, and we take the ends and the corners from the most severely affected and the least severely affected, and only those people need to be typed on these million markers to identify these genes that are involved. This graph is simply to indicate that the bigger the study is, the more findings we can make, and the more powerfully we can do this. It's well worthwhile to do this with all the clinically collected samples, but we can approach these in a different route. We can take this data and do moderately sophisticated statistical analysis and ask ourselves, how good are we going to be at finding specific DNA mutations, DNA variants? And we have about an 86% chance of detecting variants that contribute only 3% to that severity difference. So if we had 30 genes that are each contributing equally to the modification of the process, we could find every single one of them, or 86% of them, if we have 3,000 people participating. If only 1,400 boys were participating, we'd only have a 10% chance. We'd only find 1/10 of those. There's roughly 14,000 boys that are affected in the U.S., so there's no shortage of people that are affected, unfortunately, and we should be able to proceed with these relatively large studies. I just make one final point. We really don't know, and this is my admission of ignorance of this, is that how many genes is going to be involved. The mouse studies have not translated into human studies. That is, those mouse genes that are strong modifiers of the process in the MDX mouse, we don't know if human variations in those same genes that modified the dystrophic process in humans. Those aren't linking up. But there might be a few genes that are modifying the process. There might be many genes, and either answer is good news. Few genes mean they're big effect. We'd really like to study those. Many genes, we have many new insights into the dystrophic process and many new therapeutic approaches. And then finally, what we can do with these is, you'll hear about Project Catalyst, which Pat had mentioned, and other efforts for doing high-throughput screening. That high-throughput screening can't move forward without a specific target. Unless you know what you're going after and you're trying to modify, you can't try to make new drugs. So this is the first step in that process of trying to identify either drugs that could be used off the shelf or inventing entirely new drugs. And there's a series of such efforts going on. I'm just listing a few of them here, but I also just highlighting that there's NIH-funded dollars that are going into high-throughput screening that just simply getting out the word that there's many more specific targets will empower scientists to pursue these on their own right with NIH-funded money, and that extends what we're able to do. So I'm just going to put out my pitch. Absolutely, please participate in Duchenne Connect. There's a Saturday AM breakout session as well, I understand. And I was listening to NPR the other day, and a quote from Mother Teresa struck me, and I think it's very similar to what Pat was saying as well, is that each of us bring a small bit to the table, but that small bit is actually quite critical. So I'm just going to stop by acknowledging a series of colleagues, both at UCLA, who are involved in a high-throughput screening effort, and our colleagues at Novartis Foundation. And I want to particularly highlight Rochelle Crosby and Melissa Spencer, who are giving us a real-time education of muscular dystrophy pathology. Thank you very much.